Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching people how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, does science come with worldview presuppositions? Ken, some people might answer that question negatively, but no less an intellectual than Friedrich Nietzsche would say, hold on a minute. And I think you're going to introduce him for us here at the beginning.
Yeah, Joe and Dave, it seems to me that a lot of people have the impression that science is merely a practice. It's an enterprise, and if you follow the rules, you will get truth or you'll gain knowledge about the world in which we live. And so that's the first assumption that people have. It's a popular assumption, and I'm going to try to show that it's incorrect. But the first idea that, Joe, that often people have is that science is just a practice. And if you you do it regardless of your beliefs, you know, you get the truth. And then, of course, the other side of that kind of element is that science has no commitment to belief system or worldview ideas. And I think both of those are false. And I'm going to start off the program introducing the idea that I think that science, along with a number of other areas, is deeply indebted to a theistic worldview generally, a Christian view particularly. And what are some of the problems that we have with what I'm going to call secular science?
All right.
Well, I came across a quotation. I was reading a book, an interesting book entitled, it wasn't a novel, it was nonfiction. I'm equivocating there, Dave. I wish I could remember the author's name, and I don't think I can, but it was a book entitled How the Catholic Church Created Western Civilization, or something to that effect. And in the book, it had a chapter on the Catholic Church and science, and it raised the issue of how much influence did Christianity generally and Catholicism in particular have when it came to this scientific revolution in the 1600s that's really, I think it's fair to say, I think science has turned the world on its ear. Science has challenged us in many particular areas. But in reading that book, I came across this quotation, and I liked it so much. I thought it was such a thoughtful quote that I want to read it. This is from Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, some of you listening to the program will know that Nietzsche is a very celebrated atheist. His dates, to give you a little context, are 1844 to 1900. And Nietzsche, of course, was the philosopher that said many outrageous things. But one of the challenging things that he said was, God is dead. And I want to develop that in this context of what would a secular worldview look like and how would science function in it. But here's this quotation. Nietzsche says, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as science without any presuppositions. A philosophy, a faith, must always be there first of all, so that science can acquire from it a direction, a meaning, a limit, a method, a right to exist. It is still a metaphysical faith that underlies our faith in science, and we men of knowledge of today, we godless men and anti-metaphysicians, we too still derive our flame from the fire ignited by a faith millennia old, the Christian faith, which was also Plato's, that God is truth, that truth is divine. Well, what I found powerful about that is, of course, Nietzsche was kind of the new atheist of his time, and I want to compare atheism 200 years ago to atheism today. But, you know, Nietzsche was living right at the time of Darwin. He lived at a time in which astronomy said, you know, we have this Copernican principle, Dave, that the Earth is not at the center of the solar system or at the center of the universe. Maybe it's just kind of a mediocre, it's in a backwater galaxy, solar system that's not all that important. And when you start putting things together, like maybe human beings are not special creations, maybe we have evolved, maybe the Earth isn't all that special after all. So Nietzsche essentially said, we have adopted a secular worldview, but notice that Friedrich Nietzsche points out something very significant, that the Christian roots for science run deep. And even though there are many people today who believe deeply in science and want to practice it, you really can't separate the practice of science from the philosophical assumptions that drive it. And I think this is interesting, that though Nietzsche grew up in a Lutheran home, his dad was a Lutheran minister, his dad got sick and suffered significantly. I think that was part of Friedrich Nietzsche moving away from his Christian roots. But Nietzsche nevertheless always kind of felt pulled back to his early faith. He said, for example, he would never forget the first time he ever heard Handel's Messiah, that it just hooked him. My friend and distinguished Christian philosopher Ronald Nash took the view that Nietzsche maybe wasn't as much of an atheist as we think, that he enjoyed kind of jabbing at Christianity. Some of the things Nietzsche would say, for example, if you want me to believe in your Redeemer, why don't you act a little more redeemed? That is, I think some of the old atheists were more formidable than some of the new atheists today. One, because they studied Christianity. Nietzsche knew the Christian faith. He also knew the challenges of Christianity. For example, in Christianity, there's this huge gap between Christ and Christians. And Nietzsche knew how to needle that. You don't act a lot like your Savior. If you did, you know, you might make it more believable. Well, I think the old atheists understood Christianity. Nietzsche very much understood that science has philosophical assumptions, even theological assumptions. And to do science without those philosophical, theological assumptions is going to be very difficult. But I think he went a little bit further, just to kind of give you the broad context, if you will. Here's what Nietzsche's big concern was. He believed in the 19th century that God was dead. And that doesn't mean that there was a God and that God died. What it meant was that in sophisticated intellectual European culture, the intelligentsia no longer believed in God. Maybe for a variety of reasons. Maybe the church had lost its way and had lost some of its power and influence. But Nietzsche's going to focus some of this, a good bit of this, on science. Darwin made it a whole lot harder to believe in the traditional Christian view of God. Again, I mentioned astronomy. The Earth has kind of lost its center place. Secular philosophy became much more popular.
Was Freud a contemporary, or was that later?
Freud would come along a little bit later, okay. But, you know, I've mentioned this before when we talked about C.S. Lewis. I mean, that last 50 years before the beginning of the 20th century, it's a very secular period. It's the age in which Karl Marx is presenting his dialectical materialism. So atheism in politics. Freud, very secular in his views of psychology, right? Nietzsche now, in philosophy, this is a very secular period, so much so that I've said that Lewis would become a Christian. It's an extraordinary event. He was exposed to a lot of this idea. Mm-hmm. Well, here's Nietzsche's idea. Nietzsche says, look, Western civilization is built upon Christianity. It's built upon Christian values. It's built upon the idea that people are made in the image of God. Many of the significant enterprises of the world are built on this idea that human beings are special, that God has created the world. And Nietzsche actually has real concern. He says, you know, God's now dead, which means the intellectuals no longer believe in God. And here's the concern that he raised. He said, look, if God doesn't exist, then humans are no longer special. If God doesn't exist, then there isn't any necessity to say that there's objective morality. Nietzsche thought by killing God or declaring God's death, it left Europe without a foundation for many of these critical ideas. He said, you know, if we're not made in the image of God and we are just the product of blind mechanistic natural processes, then why should we necessarily follow the golden rule? Where is our morality going to be grounded if it can't be grounded in God? And this quote from Nietzsche also indicates, I think, that he meant to communicate that even our understanding of science is built upon a religious faith, that the world is a particular way. And I have proposed, based upon reading what other philosophers of science have said, that to do science, you have to have a particular world. It has to be an orderly cosmos rather than a disorderly chaos. But also human beings have to be a particular way. They have to be able to do math and logic, and they have to have, there has to be a congruence between their mind and the world. Well, I think Nietzsche indicated that secularism has a hard time kind of grounding all of this. Now,
let me ask you a question.
Yeah, sure.
If Nietzsche recognizes that there are, to do science, you have to have certain presuppositions, the presuppositions are about the nature of the world that we're studying in science, where does he think that these qualities come from? Where does he think that they, I mean, we think that they come from the fact that God made, but where does he think? I mean, if you have to have these presuppositions, and he acknowledges that, where does he think these qualities that we're presuming come from?
Yeah. Well, I think in part, Dave, he is he has an agenda. Part of that agenda is to show how deeply rooted Western civilization is in the Judeo-Christian scriptures.
Okay.
So he's going to indicate that, look, if you make everything depend upon God, if morality depends upon God, if your aesthetic views depend upon God, if your scientific views depend upon God, what happens when you pull God out of the picture?
Right.
His thought is nihilism. If God does not exist and we don't have a foundation for morality and meaning and goodness and truth, goodness and meaning, that's really what he's saying. In Western civilization, God is the anchor. God is the ground for truth, goodness, and beauty. If you take God away, then that artifice is ready to collapse.
But then we can't do science anymore in his view.
And this raises the question, how do we then rebuild an entirely secular philosophy of life? Without morality, do we give in to nihilism? Do we just throw up our hands and say, you know, there's no meaning and purpose in life? Or do we kind of look this meaningless, purposeless existence and, you know, kind of pull ourselves up and try to create our own morality, try to create our own godless worldview and civilization? And by the way, I think Nietzsche to some degree thought that maybe science was overreaching. that if science is deeply dependent upon philosophy and theology, maybe we had to rethink the implications of science and those kinds of things. But what the point I want to make here is simply this. This is sometimes made, I've heard it presented by those who are in the presuppositionalist approach to doing apologetics. I heard Greg Bahnsen, who was somebody that I knew years ago, Greg would talk about borrowed capital, that Christian civilization and the Christian worldview had anchored a lot of these things. The secularist wants to use science and I think secularists today would like to believe that there's objective morality, that there's, we'll just use it, truth, goodness, and beauty. I think the secularist would like to think, I can still have truth, goodness, and beauty. But what some Christian apologists have said is what you don't understand is all of those beautiful things, truth, goodness, and beauty, it's anchored in God. And if God doesn't exist, then you have a secular worldview that can't anchor these kinds of things. So science is part of the meaningfulness. Science is part of the truthfulness. How do you guarantee logic? How do you guarantee mathematics? How do you guarantee morality if there's no God? I think Nietzsche understood that. And part of what he attempted to do, he talked about the transvaluation of values, the will to power, the Übermensch, the overman, where he says that atheists just have to face up to the fact that a lot of things we have believed in have been grounded in God, and if we dismiss God, we're going to have to come up with a new way of thinking about all these kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. But I just have to be candid. I find it interesting that one of the leading atheists who lived at a time when Darwin was alive, that Nietzsche understood that the scientific enterprise itself is based upon an intricate number of belief systems. And if those belief systems are not true, then science can't function. So we're now at the idea of saying, hey, look, what are those presuppositions of science?
Yeah.
Right?
You know, Ken, I wonder what some of the leading figures today, you mentioned the new atheists, Lawrence Krauss, I don't know if he's officially one of them, but Richard Dawkins, Peter Atkins, you've mentioned.
Sean Carroll.
What they would think of Nietzsche, and in particular this quote where the word faith is used several times.
Yeah.
I wonder what they think about
this. This is very similar to what Paul Davies has said. He has an article wrote in the New York Times, Taking Science on Faith. And again, we're kind of back to those early beliefs I talked about right at the beginning of the program. Some people think that science is just an intellectual practice. And if you do the practice right, you get the results. And part of believing that is that science doesn't involve any faith. It doesn't involve any beliefs. But in reality, science was birthed within a Christian worldview context because seemingly the Judeo-Christian faith had all of those fundamental beliefs that fit with the potential enterprise of science. Now, let me make one more point before we kind of go back to these preconditions or these assumptions or these presuppositions. What have to be in place for science to work? I want to raise an expression, the term cognitive dissonance. You know, it's the idea that there are occasions when we have beliefs within us that we hold very dear, but we also realize that we have behaviors that don't fit with those beliefs. I think original sin has a lot of explanatory power. You know, there are times where I'll use myself as a good example. I believe if you could describe Christianity in one word, I think the word that I would pick would be grace. I believe that salvation is a gift of God. I believe that salvation begins with the triune God. God's love comes to us in the person of Jesus Christ. He empowers his Spirit to come on to the church. So we're saved by grace alone. I can't earn salvation. I don't deserve salvation. God is a generous, loving, giving person. Now, so I hold very strongly that people are saved by grace. But the cognitive dissonance is this. While I think being generous and gracious and loving is the most important thing in the world, you don't have to look too carefully at my life to see the cognitive dissonance. That is, there are times where I hold the idea of grace so dearly, but sometimes I discover in myself that I don't always relate to other people graciously. And I wonder, where is this disconnect, right? Where is this disconnect? Well, I think the Christian worldview is able to explain that. And I like Blaise Pascal's idea that there's two elements at work there. I'm great because I'm made in the image of God, but I'm wretched because of the fall. And God has not only saved me, past tense, but God is in the process of saving me, sanctification, and then there will be a time when he will bring it to completion, glorification. So as a Christian, there are times where I have very good ideals, but I don't always live up to them. Now, what I'd like to say is this. I wonder if there is a cognitive dissonance in worldviews. And what I mean by that is in naturalism, in secularism, the idea that the material world is all there is, there's no supernatural, there's no God. So this is atheism, this is skepticism, no religion type of philosophy. I wonder if there isn't a cognitive dissonance in all of this, because what I mean is, I think that atheists would like to believe in things like truth and goodness and beauty. You know, to do science, you have to believe in truth. You know, even if it's in a limited sense, there's real information to be gained. It's information that's true about the universe for all people. Well, I think that I think secularists would like to believe in truth, goodness, and beauty, but I don't think their foundation can provide it. I think an atheist would like to believe that Joe and Dave, you guys have inherent dignity and moral worth. That, you know, I respect you. You have value. But then we think, well, maybe we evolved from the apes. Maybe we're just the product of blind mechanistic natural processes. Do I necessarily have to conclude that I should do unto you as you would do unto me? Maybe I ought to do you before you do me. And so the idea here is I think that secularists have this great sense of pride in reason and rationality, but I'm not sure that their worldview can ground it. So I think, is it possible that there's a cognitive dissonance? Secularists like truth, goodness, and beauty. They like rationality. They like reason. But the worldview foundation that they have doesn't provide those kinds of things. And I think that's where we can come back and say, look, science is an extraordinarily influential enterprise. It may very well be one of the most remarkable enterprises that human beings have ever come up with. I mean, think about the practical side. I mean, this morning when I got up, getting ready for work, my wife picked up my medication from Walgreens, and I can take this pill, and it'll help my blood pressure to be sustained. You think of you think of the things that have come out of medicine and all of those kinds of areas. Well, that's very powerful. But see, here I'm going to take us back to this idea. Science involves beliefs. Science works if certain things are right in the world and in human beings. And the Christian theistic worldview not only seems to account better for these things we need to do science, it seems to be a natural fit for this. Stanley Yockey, who was a physicist, a Catholic scholar, thinker, Yockey wrote a couple different books, and he argued that there's something unique about Christianity, and he was a Catholic, so he thought the ideal expression of the Christianity for him would be Catholicism. But Yockey looked at science, and he thought other worldviews, other civilizations, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, even Baghdad, that these particular civilizations with their differing worldview ideas, sometimes religious, sometimes less so, that they had left science stillborn, mm-hmm. that science couldn't reach the critical mass so that it could unleash this scientific revolution. And I think of science as kind of a train. It gets up momentum, and now it's moving at a rapid pace. But could I propose this? Could I propose that there are a lot of scientists, and some of them are secular. There are a lot of scientists who are religious, but there are many scientists who are not. I wonder if they see this enterprise of science like a freight train moving faster and more successful and accomplishing all of these things, but they don't realize the rail that has to hold it all up. Mm-hmm. They don't realize how it came into being. And, you know, every time we get a new scientist at RTB, I always ask them, why does science work? And
it just works.
That's what they all say. But in reality, science works because the world is a particular way. There, not just any world would facilitate science. And not just any creature would facilitate science. So I want to come back to some of those things. I also want to talk about a scientist that I've been reading recently who talks about these ideas of the preconditions or the presuppositions of science. And again, how well these fit in a Christian worldview.
All right. Terrific.
Well, let's return to this idea. But by the way, one more point about Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was very influential in kind of taking the philosophy of existentialism and moving it in the secular direction. But I think Nietzsche is also an important thinker in terms of secular postmodernism. So if you haven't read Nietzsche or you're not familiar with him, he's a mover, he's a shaker when it comes to these various philosophical ideas. Well, let me return to something we've talked about before, but I think it's so important we want to return to it again. Science works because there are certain assumptions. Again, assumptions about the world, assumptions about the world of ideas. So to have science, for science to work, the world has to, the physical material world has to be a particular way. And for science to work, the conceptual world has to be a particular way. And human beings have to be a particular way. What do I mean by that? Well, there are some underlying assumptions that are not validated by science itself, but they're kind of the assumptions we begin with. Now, what are some of these things? I outline them in a couple of my books. I'm working on a new book in which I have a couple chapters talking about this issue. But I say, for example, that in order for a scientist to go about their work and have confidence that they'll get appropriate results, here are the presuppositions that go into it, that there's an objective, there's the objective reality of the cosmos. The cosmos is not a figment of my imagination, Dave. The cosmos is real, independent of my perception and of my mind. It's really there. It's out there. Again, that's very different than Hinduism. That's very different than other particular worldviews. A second assumption or presupposition, the basic intelligibility of the cosmos. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing that the cosmos is not only there, and it's apart from me, it's independent of my mind, but my little pea brain can actually understand something about the universe. So not only is the universe to some degree understandable, that is, I can study it, I can gain information about it, but I seem to have, as a human being, the qualities that would lead to me gaining an understanding of its intelligibility. A third presumption of science, assumption, precondition, presupposition, order, regularity, and uniformity are in nature. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about this, what if only part of the universe was ordered? Dave, what if I did experiments on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but if I did them on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, they'd have completely different results. There is order, there's regularity, there's uniformity. Not only where I do the experiment, but when I do the experiment. So the world's there, it's intelligible, it's ordered. And then there's this amazing thing that math and logic work. They're valid. That I can use mathematics as a language almost. I can use it to understand the physical cosmos itself. That I can draw logical inferences. The laws of logic are there, right? Then the basic reliability of human cognitive faculties and sensory organs. So again, I'm developing this idea that not only do you have to have a particular world for science to work, but you have to have human beings that have these amazing qualities. Their brain has to be reliable. Their mind, brain, mind have to be reliable. And think of, by the way, how much of science is dependent upon seeing, hearing, smelling, the empirical side. So my senses have to be, they're not perfect. I mean, a bear, lions have a greater sense of smell. Animals sometimes have more strength. But humans seem to have this extraordinary quality where their sensory organs are keen. They're basically reliable. It doesn't mean they can't be deceived. Again, science kind of helps us to narrow the parameters so we can repeat things to make sure there aren't variables that are changing things. But we also have to think that not only are there laws of logic and mathematical principles, but my mind can actually grasp them. My mind can work through them. You know, I only took a number of science classes, but I remember taking biology and I took a physics course. But I remember thinking through all of these, you know, what family do we classify that? What genus? What species? And I was thinking, wow, human beings have this remarkable capacity to lay out a systematic analysis. But of course, we came from a secular point of view, we came from a source that can't do any of that.
There's none of that.
So human beings, they marshal all their abilities to then look at nature. But if nature coughed us up, that is, if there's no God and we're the product of materialism and physicalism, then there was no purposer. There was no designer. There was no ultimate engineer. This kind of tumbled into place to some degree. this is, again, what I'm getting back to and what I'm going to call a cognitive dissonance of worldview. You can be a secularist and you can believe very deeply in the remarkable abilities of science, and you can believe in truth, goodness, and beauty. But does your worldview have the strength to hold up all of that? Nietzsche came along and said, look, guys, if we're going to be atheists, we're going to have to rethink all of the foundations for what we think was a civilization. Let me continue here. The congruence between the human mind and physical reality. So not only does the world have to be a particular way, the world has to be real, the world has to be intelligible, it has to be ordered and regular, uniform, math and logic have to work, but and the human mind, brain, and senses have to work, but then they have to have this connectedness. There has to be a congruence. I think of computers. It seems like we have to be networked together. Of course, I think all of this screams theism.
Yeah.
It screams a biblical perspective where God creates the world with nomos and logos. He creates us in his image. Then he networks us together. So then science is seen as not just a remarkable practical enterprise, but it's kind of part of our devotion as creatures. Another element here, that an acceptable criteria for an adequate hypothesis exists. That is, you know, scientists have to think, okay, here's my hypothesis, and here's how you do a proper hypothesis. This is what goes into a viable hypothesis, but here's how all that can break down. So I have to recognize that, you know, there has to be consistency. There has to be a correspondence. Two more elements here.
That, by the way, is a big issue today because a lot of cosmologists, for instance, are intrigued with various theories just because they're beautiful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not necessarily because they're testable.
Yeah.
And correspond to reality.
Well, and that raises, Dave, I think, a very important question. Do we want to say that science is essentially empirical and observable? What if somebody comes along and says, well, I think a lot for the multiverse. Well, how many of those universes have you observed?
Yeah.
I think you could even ask the question, is it possible we will ever be able to observe any of that? And how much of science is based upon observation and empiricism? Those are critical questions. The last one, that what is observed in nature can provide clues and indications of unobservable patterns and processes. That is, sometimes we can observe things and they'll tip us off to other things that we cannot directly observe. Now, what I'm saying here, and I've repeated this many times, I've written about it, I continue to write about it, I continue to talk about it, and that is, science doesn't work in a vacuum. Science works if there are certain things that are true about the world in which we live. Science works if there is a conceptual world. Science works if human beings are of a particular variety. Max Tegmark, for example, at MIT, he says, you know, you need a physical world, and then you need a conceptual world of math and science, and then you need consciousness. Well, I don't know what Max Tegmark's views are. I'm assuming he's probably a skeptic or an agnostic, but I know when I read his demeanor and when I hear him talk, he's not hostile to the idea of religion. But he might still say, you know, the universe is a remarkable place, but that doesn't mean there has to be a God. But I think that's very powerful. I think people like Max Tegmark and Roger Penrose, for example, Penrose acknowledges that you've got the physical cosmos out there, but then you've got this world of invisible ideas called mathematics. He doesn't think we made them up. He thinks you discover them. And then there's the human consciousness. Well, how do we fit all these things together? I think that Christian theism is the best explanation, because let's just isolate science. I mean, again, we could talk about things like morality. We could talk about things like aesthetics. We could individualize things like logic and reason. So there are all these kind of details. We could also talk about human beings. Why do human beings want to live forever? Why are they so religious? We could look at all of these clues, if you will, that I think point to God. But let's just isolate on science. When we look at science, the world has to be a particular way. And human beings have to be a particular way. And these philosophical assumptions, and this is a very, very, very important point. These preconditions that I've talked about, these assumptions, these presuppositions, they're not determined by science. Mm-hmm. That is, these are not things we derive from science. These are things we believe before we start to do science. Now, to some degree, I think it's right that, look, we say, wow, isn't there this remarkable connection between mathematical ideas in the universe? And we say, hey, you know, Einstein came up with this equation. Then we've done some testing and observing, and wow, there is this connection.
So science confirms these things.
But confirmation is very different than grounding or discovering. We simply say, wow, there does seem to be a connection here, but that doesn't invent mathematics. That doesn't invent the way things are. Mm-hmm. These are still assumptions. These are still presuppositions. It's more like that we let these things guide our reasoning rather than inventing these kinds of things. Hmm. Now,
so this is what Nietzsche was getting at, right?
I think it's a remarkable thing. I think that secularism, I think that naturalism, they have a hard time grounding rationality, because if there's no mind, you know, if mind didn't create nature, if nature created mind, and those are moving in two very different directions, if there's a mind out there, an infinite eternal mind that belongs to God, and not only does he have this mind, he has power, and he can will, and he's everywhere present, and he's all loving and good, he can create the universe, he can create nature. So he's an engineer, he's an architect, he's all of these things. But what if there is no mind? And the universe just happens to be here, and through blind mechanistic natural processes, we luckily and accidentally came into being. Those are moving in two different directions. So let's suppose you believe that nature coughed up human beings. I'm using language there. I'm trying to provoke some emotive thought going on here. But what if you do believe that a mindless universe, nature created human minds? How reliable, how confident can you be in reason? How do you know? Maybe evolution put false positives in your mind. How about morality? You know, I think raping and torturing people is wrong. I think it's right to be honest and courageous. I think it's wrong to be brutal. But then, of course, who says? What if we're the product of natural processes? You know, I don't seem, you know, when a fly gets in the house, it irritates me. I want to go gunning for that fly. I'm going to kill him.
That's too much energy.
And I may kill all of them I can possibly can, but I don't feel any guilt. I think, boy, don't ever come in my house. This is, you don't belong here. And, you know, or ants will come in, might invade the kitchen. You know, my son may have left some chocolate cake in the sink, and the ants crinkle in there. And I think, man, where's this legion of ants come from? Where were they before? But, you know, we'll get some spray,
Raid.
My loving, caring wife, she just obliterates them. Doesn't think a second thought about it. Why couldn't a person come along, Joe and Dave, and say, you know, my name is Joseph Stalin. My name is Chairman Mao, Pol Pot, Hitler. I have the power to decide your fate.
And you're annoying me.
And I've decided that it benefits me to get rid of you. Hmm. Or I don't like Jews. And so the Nazi movement would say the official policy is we're going to get rid of this whole race of people. If there's no God, then what's the anchor for values? Now, don't get me wrong. I very much believe that most atheists believe that there are objective morality in life. But saying that and grounding it are two very different things. Truth, goodness, and beauty. Why is there so much beauty in the world? Is it just there? Why are we able to detect it? Why is it there? If evolution can explain things, why is it that beauty seems to be non-utilitarian? It doesn't help our survivability. But again, if God is an artist, that puts things in a very different kind of context. And
you know,
go ahead, Dave.
Well, just this idea of, there's no grounding for these things. It brings out what I would call the distinction between preferences and convictions.
Yeah.
Convictions are things you believe and you're willing to die for. Preferences are, I prefer to be honest, but I'll compromise if there's some other benefit to be gained by compromising it. And so we can compromise a lot of these things that we think are truths because they're not really convictions based on some fundamental truth.
That's right. So in one sense, you don't have to believe in Christianity to be a scientist. You don't have to be a Christian to practice good science. But you do, in order to practice science, you have to accept a group of assumptions that historically and philosophically fit very well with a particular religious worldview. That there's a real world, ordered, regular, intelligible. Humans have these qualities and capacities. I don't know where math came from. I don't know where logic came from, but they're here. It's in the toolbox. So you don't have to be a Christian to be a scientist. You don't have to be a Christian to be a good scientist. But can you be a non-Christian or a non-theist? Because I'm sure our Jewish friends are going to come in and say, I'm not a Christian, but I believe in all these things because Christianity shares our worldview,
right. Granted.
But can you justify all these beliefs? And that's where I think science is so highly specialized. There's so much specialized. I mean, I've been in a room with three or four different kinds of physicists, or I've been in a room with different kinds of biologists, and they're so specialized in their particular field. But the specialization in education often results in we don't think about the philosophical or the possible theological implications of doing science.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, a number of years ago, I had the opportunity to go over to the Soviet Union at that time. It was still the Soviet Union. And speak to the Russian Academy of Sciences.
Wow.
Partly about science that I was doing, But we were also invited. This was a time when the Soviet Union was almost coming apart.
Yeah.
And so there was a greater freedom to share, you know, religious viewpoints. And so I had the opportunity to share my Christian faith and my testimony. And
yeah.
There were lots of questions about that, more questions about that than on my science.
Interesting.
But one of the questions that came up quite frequently was they would readily acknowledge the validity of the moral principles taught in Scripture. But why do you have to believe in Jesus Christ? Why do you have to believe in the, you know, some of the more difficult things that are in Scripture? Yeah. And, you know, the answer that I gave was that we as human beings can acknowledge all of these good things, but do we have the power to actually carry them out in our life? Do we have the power to not compromise are these convictions or these yeah. preferences that we have? Or will we always, under some circumstance, under some pressure, give in?
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we spoke about, it was important for a scientist, is his integrity, his honesty. But we find that scientists, under pressure of, you know, needing to be successful or
sell books,
write papers, or be influential, will compromise their integrity and publish results that they haven't really verified or are not necessarily accurate. And so they can't keep the values that they believe in.
You know, Dave, this is a good kind of place to end our show on. Joe, next time I'd like to extend to it a little further. Next time, I want to bring in a distinguished scientist, not in studio, but I want to read from his writings, John Barrow, particularly from his book, The Universe That Discovered Itself. Mm. But one of the points that I want to make here and now, Dave, is the very interesting point you've made, and that is cognitive dissonance. You know, the human heart is complicated. The human heart, I mean, Pascal said that people don't like to sit alone in their room and think about reality. I think when you start to have some introspection, when you start thinking, you realize that, I may face some critical issues in my life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Where do I get my validity? Why do I feel an aloneness, maybe even a loneliness? And then, Dave, how come I aspire to be a particular type of person, and yet there is this flawed nature that I have? I mean, I think of scientists and philosophers and sometimes theologians, where they approach their discipline with real integrity, but then you look at their personal life and it's reckless. They're very flawed people. But when it comes to their craft, doing science, being honest, being very careful, yet in their personal life, they may be unfaithful to their spouse. They may drink and live in such a way that is not kind of supporting human flourishing, if you will. Well, that can happen to philosophers as well. I can give the lecture, but then how do I live that life? And it happens with theologians. And when it happens with theologians, and when it's exposed, then people think, here's a guy who says that he knows the right way, but he can't even live up to it. Of course, part of that is, of course, always concerning when you discover that maybe some of your favorite theologians were not as perfect as you thought they were. But remember the premise of the Bible. Human beings are made in the image of God, but they're now fallen. And that pointer, Dave, I think is a very powerful one. One inference we can draw is that we need God's help. We're in a desperate situation. we need a Savior. And we're back to that word that I believe so deeply in, grace. And so what I'd like to do is in our next program, we'll dig a little deeper in these, what I'm calling preconditions of science, call them assumptions, presuppositions. Some of them are philosophical. Probably all of them are philosophical. Some have theological implications. But instead of me kind of bringing it from a philosophical, theological vantage point, I want to look at a very distinguished scientist and what he says about these assumptions of science.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you for that.
Joe, one more thing. I talk about some of these ideas in Seven Truths That Changed the World, as well as in my book, Without a Doubt.
Okay, great. And you can go to our store here at reasons.org and pick up those books at your leisure. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Remember, you can reach us with your comments or questions on Ken's Twitter account, at RTB_KSamples, and be sure to check out Ken's blog as well, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.